You'll be able to dive straight back in.
I license you to do that.
And greetings to you all. My name is Elizabeth Baker Keffer, and I'm publisher of The Atlantic, and happy to be here this morning to kick off our session on the World Economy Track, What is Sustainable Development? With Clive Crook, our moderator, and to Clive's left, Nancy Birdsall, then Harriet Favitt, Larry Summers, and Cameron Sinclair. And Clive will introduce the panelists, but I thought I would take a moment, in addition to welcoming you all, to introduce my colleague Clive Crook, who is senior editor of The Atlantic and also writes a regular column in The Atlantic and in National Journal. Clive also serves as chief editorial advisor to Atlantic Media Company, to our chairman, David Bradley. And I've had the good pleasure of working with him as a close colleague for a year now, almost a year to the day. Clive's first day on the job was at the Aspen Ideas Festival last year. And I've said to him, often, life and work is not always like this, to be out here in Aspen meeting with this
so
group of people. Yes. So happy one-year anniversary to Clive. Clive's background was that he joined us from The Economist. He'd been writing columns for National Journal for a few years, but had been at The Economist for more than 15 years. The most recent posting was as the deputy editor there. And he moved over to Washington last July, started here with us in Aspen. He was educated at Oxford and at the London School of Economics, and previously also served as a consultant to the World Bank and was an official in the British Treasury. So I will turn things over to Clive. Thank you all.
Thanks. That's probably more about me than you needed to know, but I'm grateful for the introduction. Thanks very much. Well, we're here to discuss what is sustainable development. As you can see, we're a relatively small group, which is good because I'm hoping that we can get a proper discussion, a proper conversation going between members of the panel and members in the audience. And so I'm going to encourage our speakers to be quite brief in making opening remarks. Brief but provocative would be ideal, so that we can get a debate going. Before I introduce the speakers, I'm just going to be a little bit provoking, if you don't mind, and spend 2 minutes, no more than 2 minutes, framing the debate just by telling you why I think this is an interesting and not a straightforward question. What is sustainable development? When you look through the program for this meeting, you see the word sustainable again and again in all kinds of different contexts. The premise of any statement, including the word sustainable, is that sustainability is good. It's simply never questioned. Sustainable, who would want unsustainable development? Who would want unsustainable anything? And the word has now crept into the official, more than crept, actually, it's commandeered the official vocabulary of most of the aid agencies, including the World Bank, who now cast their objectives in their development policies in terms of sustainable development. But what actually does this term mean? I'm hoping for enlightenment myself in the course of this discussion because I'm a little bit puzzled by this term. On one definition of sustainable, and I hear this definition quite a lot, we're told that sustainable means leaving the planet as we found it for future generations. Now, if you take that literally, it's physically impossible. That's the first problem with that definition. But even if you allow a little bit of elasticity there and say, well, let's not take that quite literally, that sentiment, that idea still raises some difficult questions. For instance, the exploitation of any non-renewable resource is, literally speaking, unsustainable. Does that mean we shouldn't exploit any non-renewable resource? That would be an odd conclusion to my mind. If you think back in economic history, think back to the Industrial Revolution, that was plainly an unsustainable phenomenon. At the beginning, in the early years of the Industrial Revolution, if you'd asked, can this go on forever? Should it go on forever? I think many people would have said no. It certainly wasn't environmentally sustainable. And yet, can we now, with a clear conscience and a clear head, look back and say we would have preferred it if the Industrial Revolution had never happened? So I think this concept of sustainability raises some quite deep issues about the way we should think about development and the way we should organize our development policies. Now, that's enough from me. We have a fantastic panel of speakers to address this issue. I'm hoping they agree with me that it's an interesting subject. If they don't, we're in trouble. But we have got some terrific speakers up here. Now, let me introduce them. On my immediate left is Nancy Birdsall. Nancy is one of the most well-regarded development economists in the world. She was a senior official at the World Bank for many years and then a senior official at the Inter-American Development Bank. Then she founded the Center for Global Development. She heads that center now in Washington. And the center is probably the most respected think tank policy action, policy design institute for developing countries, well, maybe in the world, certainly in the U.S., I would say. So it's great to have Nancy. Harriet Bannett, moving next along, was the U.S. representative to the Organization of American States. She was formerly the deputy administrator of USAID. She sits on numerous boards, notably, for the purposes of this discussion, the board of the World Resources Institute. Larry Summers is probably the face on this panel that you don't recognize. I'll need to say a little bit more about Larry. Larry is the former president of Harvard University, a former secretary of the U.S. Treasury, and even if you put those minor public service achievements to one side, you would have to say he is one of the towering economic scholars of our time. That is no exaggeration. That is not hype. So I'm honored to have him with us on this group. And finally, we have Cameron Sinclair. He is the co-founder and the head of Architecture for Humanity. Those of you who were here at the beginning of the conference will know Cameron already because he spoke in the initial session. He was one of the brave volunteers to speak for 3 minutes on great ideas that might change the world, and I thought he did very, very well. It's an assignment I would have never have accepted, I must say. Anyway, Architecture for Humanity is a not-for-profit enterprise that develops and promotes architectural solutions for the developing countries. So what I'm going to do is invite the panel in alphabetical order to speak for 5 minutes and offer an answer to the question, actually, to say whatever they want on the subject. But it would be nice if they offered an answer to the question, what is sustainable development? And then from there, I might treat myself to a question to start the conversation going, but the main thing will be to get you all involved in the debate as quickly as possible. So do please think while the speakers are talking so that we can have a debate. Harry, you're first.
The joys of having a last name to start with B entitled me to the first position. I think what I'll do is start talking a bit about, Clive mentioned the Industrial Revolution, and of course the issue around the world is often, particularly with respect to India and China, you all developed in a clearly unsustainable way during the Industrial Revolution. Who are you to tell us we can't do the same thing? And I guess I would say to that that the Industrial Revolution was a good thing. It had very bad consequences, but ultimately improved the lot of many, many people in the world, but at huge cost and huge human misery. The difference now, I would say, is that that was the 19th century. We really did not understand the costs, and we didn't know how to mitigate them. We do understand the costs now. We do understand better how to mitigate them. And very fundamentally, we are much closer to the edge in terms of what we can do as a planet. We could not do what we did in the Industrial Revolution, the scale that we did at its time. It would be, however, morally repugnant and politically impossible to say we want the rest of the developing world to hold back so that the developed world can continue to scoot along in this happy air-conditioned environment. The thought that I keep in the back of my mind when I'm thinking about the difference between the developed and the developing world is that a wise friend of mine once said, look, rich people can do foolish things much longer than poor people. What's the difference between the rich and the poor? The rich can do foolish things for a longer period of time, and I think that's true of developed and developing countries as well. Much of the disaster of developing in an environmentally sustainable way will fall to the developing world. I'm not going to get into economics. I certainly wouldn't be foolish enough to do that on a panel with two world-renowned economists, and I'm not going to get into global climate change in any significant way. But it's very clear from what we know now that the most disastrous results from failing to address global climate change will occur in the developing world. So the consequences of doing foolish things for the developing world are much, much harsher. The population issue, I think, is one I'd like to touch on. I just came from the panel on the changing Middle East. Many of the people on the panel talked about demographics and the issue with respect to the demographics in the Middle East. The Aspen Institute's done some wonderful work on this. I sat for 3 days in this room in a group working on biodiversity. I didn't bring the book. I meant to, but one of the pieces in the book, which we published at the end of that work, was a guy named Bob Engelman, who's done a lot of work on demographics. He refers to the human species as the many, the voracious, and the lethally successful. And by that he means that we are ubiquitous. There are other species, there's some insects and there's some aquatic animals and there's some microorganisms that outnumber us. But there's nobody, no animal, no species, nobody that outnumbers us in terms of our impact on the planet and our ability to modify the Earth's surface and the atmosphere and the energy that we consume. For a couple of millennium, the human species consumed about the same number of kilocalories a day as a dolphin. Follow me here. It's not a very long chain. We now, across the planet, consume about the same number of kilocalories a day as a pilot whale. If we are an American, you have to multiply that by six. So metaphorically speaking, those of you who are Americans in this room can consider yourselves sperm whales. We so stress the planet. If China and India develop as we see them developing, and as the economists celebrate their development, we will be a planet of sperm whales, and the planet cannot sustain it.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, you're next.
Well, I looked up the definition of sustainable development at Google, you know, and the United Nations definition is meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. You know, it sounds right, but I think the problem with that definition is that it's useless as a guide to any policy choices. This is the point, in a sense, that Clive was making. Should, in the 19th century, the British have been saving coal so that there would be more coal to burn in the 21st century? No. And today, should we be saving oil, other fossil fuels, indeed coal, in order to ensure that future generations would have this resource, this natural resource, to burn, when we know, of course, that there are costs associated with burning coal or oil or so on. So what I thought I would do is give you a sense of a very idiosyncratic approach that I have based on my understanding of development, and talk mostly about the issue of sustainable development in the developing world, and say that I'm, on the one hand, an optimist, that growth will solve the problem. If we have sustained growth in the developing world, it can and will solve the problem. And that sounds controversial because of what's happening now, for example, in China. But let me try to explain what I mean. In a sense, I believe that sustained growth, and sustained is a different word than sustainable, which I'll explain in a moment, that sustained growth could, can, and will, in many respects, lead to and be equivalent to sustainable development. Let me say that a fact that's interesting for all of you, for me to share with you, is that there is an income per capita on average in a country at which we know that people begin to demand environmental goods. I don't know exactly what it is. Larry might remember from the World Development Report that he was responsible for on environment of the World Bank in 1992, two maybe, but it's probably somewhere now around $6,000 or $7,000 per capita, which is a lot higher than is average income per capita in many developing countries. But on the other hand, many developing countries are approaching that number. And I think what Hattie was saying is the challenge we have to be met is that to both ensure that, well, Hattie was saying we need to bring that number down, and I agree with that, and I would say we also need to bring many countries up to some number that might be lower than $6,000 per capita. So what brings the number down? One is that the number can fall as it becomes cheaper to produce, say, clean air, because new technologies arise. We know, for example, a metaphor, an analogy, the cost of reducing infant mortality, the cost of saving lives, has fallen dramatically over the last 50 years because of new technologies. In the same way, we with different technologies could reduce that per capita number. The number can be lowered to the extent that societies find ways to develop a consensus around internalizing the costs of the bad things, internalizing the costs of, say, pollution, of burning fossil fuels. That requires something about the way societies are shaped and formed. And the number will be lower, we know, the more broadly shared this growth is, that I'm an optimist about, in developing countries. In a sense, the more democratic the country is, the more there are political and social institutions that ensure that growth is sustained. So what do we have to do? We want to lower the number, but we do also want income growth. We should not be anti-growth if we are pro-sustainable development. And I think this seems like a simple point, but it is often argued that the problem is growth itself. We know that many developing countries have grown for surprisingly long periods. They've grown, say, for 10 years. Some of the poorest countries in the world have succeeded in periods of growth, 8, 9, 10 years. That is insufficient because we also know that many of those countries then sink back and stop growing. So that brings me to sustained growth, growth that persists beyond, say, 10 years. Chad has grown for 10 years. Malawi has grown for 10 years. Kenya has grown for 10 years. Guatemala, Nicaragua, some of the poorest countries in the world. So how do countries find sustained growth? Here is where the ingredients of sustained growth start to be the very ingredients that lead to lowering the cost at which per capita income on average leads people to and leads societies to demand more environmental goods. So in a sense, you could say the ingredients of sustained growth are the ingredients of sustainable development. They are sound political institutions, the ability of societies to organize themselves, to internalize the costs of pollution, to impose on polluters the costs that they are imposing on the rest of society. That seems to create the incentives to find new technologies that brings down this key number, if I've got the number right, of about 6,000 per capita. Now, all of that I've said, and now I'm finishing, has to do with achieving sustainable development in poor countries where 5 billion or so of the world's population live, 4 out of 5, 5 out of 6 people. Hattie raised, I think, a key problem, which is for in the case of climate change, where individual countries, even with sustained growth, may not necessarily, we see, are not necessarily finding the way to internalize amongst themselves the costs of burning fossil fuels. This is the classic climate change is the classic case of an externality, a global public bad. And here, the same ingredients are required, in a sense, at the global level, if we are to find a way as a global society to deal with climate change. And those include growth, but they also include the institutions, the political institutions, the democracy, some sort of shadow of democracy at the global level, which would enable us as a club of nations to attack this great challenge of climate change.
Thank you very much. Cameron, it's your turn.
I'm extremely grateful to be invited by the Aspen Institute to be here, and when they told me, I was really honored, but when I saw the lineup, I was overwhelmed. So I'll introduce myself as the rough amongst the panel, because the work that I've been doing is more on the ground. We're looking at it from seeing a system. Originally, the intent of our organization was to get creative and design professionals from around the world to respond to some of these systemic issues of poverty as well as post-natural disasters. I will talk about post-natural disasters in a minute because they're one of the biggest problems that face development. What we found was when we were working on the ground that throughout the globe, as was mentioned earlier, when you don't have the luxury of having an opportunity to experiment, and it's a matter of survival, some of the most creative and innovative people are actually on the ground within the communities that we seek to serve. And so sustainable development is not just about imposing systems of growth. It's about bringing out innovation from within the community so that you can have appropriate responses to specific issues. What works in Sri Lanka does not work in India. What works in India does not work in Ghana. What works in Ghana does not work in Tanzania. I think what's happened is because the actual problems are so large, we've tried to come up with too many one size fits all approaches. And it's especially dangerous in post-disaster situations where you get many newly formed NGOs that do the playbook of recovery. And what happens primarily is that many countries that are in the midst of development are also at-risk countries to disasters. If there's an earthquake in LA, it's a 6.0, I'm sure there'll be a number of people who die, but if that same earthquake hits the mountainside cities in Chile, you may have 30,000 people dead. And many of the responses to that is to rebuild on this sustained level, the idea that we're not going to make the world worse, we're just going to keep it at the same. We can't do that. The idea of being sustainable is trying to improve the living standards of communities, but doing that in many different ways, not just economically, societal, but also in terms of disaster mitigation. So the idea is building communities that are safer, stronger, and more secure for families who want to grow within them. I also think that there's an arrogance in the West about sustainable development. We seem to assume that that means developing nations. I commented a couple of days ago about the fact that 1 in 7 people live in slums. Well, 56 million of those people live in the West. And we're actually working not just in developing countries, but here in the United States. There's levels of poverty on the North Plains, on the Native American reservations that we've been working on, as well as down on the Gulf Coast, that have been in situations of neglect, absolute neglect. And they have realized that nobody's coming to save them. Nobody's coming to help them. And when the perceived support mechanisms break down, especially on the Gulf Coast, which was so visible to us all, communities begin to form, and they begin to become very strong. And our role is not to impose systems on them, but to work with them and to try and collaborate and come up with appropriate responses so that they can define their own growth. Because the only way that a community can really become sustainable is that they have a strong sense of empowerment and ownership over that development. So the work we're doing in Biloxi is just as important as the work that we're doing in Tanzania or the work that we're doing on the east coast of Sri Lanka. I'm not going to say much more because I know there's going to be a lot for debate. But I just want to have a show of hands quickly. I'm in the creative profession, so I'm going to mention architects. Could I have a raise of hands of the number of people who could mention at least three architects? Can I have a raise of hands of the number of people who can name an African architect? Right. You see where I'm going at. So the problem is, when we talk about organization, there's also an arrogance assuming that we're a Western group. The reality is that we're working with design professionals from over 54 countries that are working within their own countries and understand the complexity of the situation, the cultural differences, the environmental differences, and also what communities really need. And for far too long, and I'm not blaming larger organizations because they've come around quite a bit, but newly formed organizations that respond to the emotional distress of the CNN poverty, you know, you'll see these small stories and somebody with all the best intentions flies over and starts an organization. They victimize people who should be active participants in the rebuilding and the renewal of their own communities. And so sustainable development is not just about systems. It's about actual creation of communities. So.
My comments are going to echo, perhaps with a slightly harder edge, some of the things that Nancy and Clive said. Before I make my primary points, I want to be very clear that I yield to no one in my commitment to the idea that much more needs to be done to promote human betterment in the poorest societies in the world, that there are very large opportunities that are being missed by current policy to make the world a better place by more effectively purchasing insurance against global climate change through a whole set of policy adjustments, that there is profound missed opportunity underway in the developing world. But I think the question of sustainable development is one that is often almost meaningless in the way it is phrased, and when attempts are made to give it meaning, they often lead to quite paradoxical views. How can one possibly disagree with the UN's definition that we need to meet the needs of present generations without compromising the needs of future generations? How can anyone possibly object to that statement? But at the same time, as Nancy pointed out, it gives almost no guidance as to how any concrete decision should be made. And I think we need to think very carefully about a kind of implicit contradiction in progressive morality. Those of us who think of ourselves as progressive tend to believe two things very strongly. We tend to think that it is a good idea for there to be redistribution from the rich to the poor, and we tend to be extremely nervous about any proposal that will lead to redistribution from the poor to the rich. We also tend to believe that we need to care deeply about the future and sacrifice today for the future. And there is, ironically, a real tension between those two views, because the future is going to be much richer than the present. Consider what life was like in America in 1907. Life expectancy was 48 years. Almost no one went to college. Half the population was literate. And by today's standards, 98% of the population lived below the poverty line. And even the John D. Rockefellers didn't enjoy things we take for granted, like the ability to be confident that your child will grow, live to adulthood, and to be in a comfortable temperature at any moment indoors, regardless of what was going on outside. What would the morality have been of their sacrificing the opportunity to be a little warmer, sacrificing the opportunity to build more schools, sacrificing the opportunity to expand cities so that we would be better off? In any other context, if you thought about redistribution from people who were that poor to people who were that rich, it would seem bizarre for that to be a major area of priority. And yet, there is every reason to believe that economic growth, that the difference between life in 2106 and life in 2006 will be greater. To just be concrete, there was no span in American history when, if you took the life expectancy and you took economic growth going forward, people's incomes over a human lifespan increased as much as sixfold. A lifespan in Asia today is 70 years. Since 1961, 46 years, per capita living standards in Asia have increased by a factor of 34. I sure hope the people in 1962 who had standards of living 3% of the average of standards of living today weren't sacrificing anything that was too important for them in order to make the people who are far richer today better off. This has very real implications for development policy. Whenever anybody says, do something for posterity, I ask myself, it better be awfully good for posterity, because there are things we can do today that cost $100 and save the life of a child. The things we can do today that cost $100 and are the difference between a child being educated and a child growing up not to be educated. The things we can do today that cost almost nothing and are not being done and have a real chance of averting a genocide in a country where a very large number of very poor people live. And so, yes, we should do things. We should purchase more insurance. But let's remember that when we're talking about doing things for people in 2070, they're going to have enormous capacity to help themselves in ways we don't envision. Let's remember that if that had happened 70 years ago, you'll wonder whether it would have been right. And let's make sure that we also think about the things we can do for people today. That's the first point I'd make. Second point I'd make is, insofar as we want to invest in posterity, let's remember that there are a lot of ways to do it. You know, if you think about what happened in our lives, which would you rather the people had done in 1900? They supported and nurtured the great universities of the world that produced quantum mechanics, that made possible the scientific progress that is the basis for the way we all live, or that they had preserved some more land in the Midwest. We might have wanted to see both, but those inventions in science were profoundly transformative of the opportunities that were open to the future. At a time when there's more research going on in the pharmaceutical industry on pet disease than on tropical disease, this is not a purely academic kind of observation. And so I would first urge that we think very hard about present needs of desperately poor people as we think about setting development priorities. Second, insofar as we're oriented to the future, we think about what the highest return investments will be. And those returns, those investments may not be in the things that the word sustainability draws you towards. They may be in other things that will contribute to the development of new institutions, to the development of new capacities for mankind. And that we remember a third point, and that we keep it in mind as discipline, as we think about what the highest priorities are. And that's this. A dollar put aside today and just invested in the world's markets can be expected to earn about 8% a year. At that rate, a dollar invested today for 50 years will be about $70.
How much was
it? 70. That's a huge amount, and they can do a lot with $70 in 2050. And so, insofar as an investment is being justified on the basis of its very long-run benefits, let's always compare it to the alternative of putting aside the resources today, accumulating them for then, and then using them at that time. There will be investments that will meet that test. The things that, anything that can genuinely be argued to be decisive between the planet collapsing and the planet not collapsing is absolutely a critical investment for us to make. But as we consider the whole range of investments, I would argue that the highest morality is in taking a rather hard-edged view in thinking about where the greatest return per dollar spent is on improving the lives of desperately poor people or saving lives, and that that discipline needs to increasingly inform the development debate.
Thank you. I've taken over for Clive, and we'll see us through to the end in case you hadn't noticed. And we will open up for questions and comments in a few moments, but I thought I'd give our panelists a chance to reflect on each other's comments or to push further. And Hattie, why don't we start with you?
Thank you. I want to address Larry's comments because, and Clive had asked us to disagree where we could to enliven the discussion. So I'm about to disagree with Larry Summers, is a fairly intimidating prospect. Larry, during the Clinton administration, made the same kind of argument with respect to climate change. In those internal Clinton administration discussions about how much energy, no pun intended, should we put into dealing with the issues of climate change. We'll have more money later. The earth, you know, we're all growing. $1 invested today, $8 in the year 2050. We can deal with it then. I disagreed then, and I disagree now. I think there are issues like climate change where you have these large countries with huge populations. Usually people usually talk about them as China and India. I would say China and India and the United States, where the consequences of not dealing with them have such a huge impact that you cannot wait. You can't wait because it takes a long time for people to understand climate change and that it's real. You can't just decide sometime that now we have enough money to deal with it in the most efficient way, because we're not an efficient folk, we humans, Homo sapiens, and we need to understand what's about to happen to us. It's taken a long time. I think an inconvenient truth helps, but it's a very big story. If you look at what China is doing today, I'm going to pick on China because I have a little bit of data, but you can say the same, certainly tell the same kinds of stories about the United States or about India. This spectacular economic growth, which we must all celebrate, means that China will probably be able to deal with its own potable water issues, its own sanitation issues on its own dollar. It doesn't need investment dollars from the international community. But it means that, for example, with respect to deforestation, China was busy clearing its own forests. They had devastating floods in 1998, understood that those floods resulted from the deforestation, and said, oops, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to go get our timber elsewhere. They're busy deforesting the rest of the developing world and selling it to the developed world, to Britain, to the United States, and others. Shame on China. Shame on the countries from which it is being, the corruption which allows it to be taken out of Papua New Guinea and put old-growth forest into plywood, which is then sold in the United States and sold in Great Britain and other places. Coal. China's the world's largest producer of coal. The coal fires burning, just burning underneath China's surface, uncontrolled coal fires burning, burn more coal and produce more carbon dioxide a year than all of Japan uses. These are big, big numbers. And the issue of waiting to deal with them, I would argue that we simply do not have the luxury. We have the luxury with respect to some issues, of course. But with respect to issues, the big issue, in my opinion, with respect to the future of the developed and the developing planet, global climate change, we don't have it. Now, when I was preparing for this talk, let me tell you that I looked over old notes from other talks, and two of the points that I made were quotes from Larry Summers. One is, one good example is worth a thousand theories, and I hope the global climate change example has convinced somebody here. And the other is that the single best investment dollar in the developing world is in girls' education. That the biggest bang for the buck, I have the exact language here, but that the single biggest bang for the buck is educating girls. It deals with the issue of overpopulation. It deals with the issue of contribution to economic growth. It deals with all those issues. It may be that we could wait with respect to girls' education, but that's not what you're saying. So I'd like to know more about when you're talking about waiting. There must be categories in here where we don't want to wait, and what are those categories?
I want to be very clear about what I am saying and what I'm not saying. I think I began and ended by saying there was an enormous amount that is not being done that should be done to protect against global climate change. And so I am not in the place of saying that we should simply wait. I am in the place of saying that as we set investment priorities, we need to ask ourselves, what will the return on different investments be? And where an investment is decisive for the future of the planet, the return will be enormously high. And we absolutely should make those investments. Where the return will pay off 20% per year, as I argued in the paper you quoted on girls' education, it is an investment we should make. But when we do what, frankly, most people who like the term sustainable development do, which is go on to say things like cost-benefit analysis is a bad idea. These questions shouldn't be approached through the prism of economic analysis. They're moral questions, and so they shouldn't be judged on the basis of measurement. Those are the times when I think we often get ourselves into, trouble. And I think we need to make some of the investments you're talking about, and my guess is we would disagree a bit on the agenda, but my guess is we wouldn't disagree completely on the agenda. But I think we do need to discipline ourselves with the awareness that there are things that we can do today, and there are things that we can do to prepare for the future. And here I'll say something where I think you will disagree with me quite strongly. I am very struck talking to my children who live in our society and go to progressive schools that are inculcated with a set of stuff. My children are very alarmed about what's going to happen to Florida 60 years from now. And they have great moral energy invested in the oceans are going to rise and so forth. They are, except from what they hear from me, without concern and have not been led to be concerned about the fact that there are hundreds of thousands of girls like them who are becoming child prostitutes in the world every year because of their poverty. And so I think this tremendous moral energy that's being inculcated in our youth is being channeled almost exclusively in the United States to environmental questions. And I don't deny the force of environmental questions, but I think there are equally compelling and in some ways more immediate moral concerns that somehow don't get put on the same moral plane. And I think the reason I am addressing this here is that I think this term sustainable development has this implication that the moral issues that are about the next century somehow have a higher and greater morality associated with them than the moral issues associated with the girls who don't learn to read and therefore can't do anything else but become prostitutes, the treatments for rehydration therapy that are not given, the AIDS research that is not done. And so I'm for all these very high return investments, but I would just argue that that in the terms of the moral force, in a world where there are 8 million children who are dying before the age of 5 needlessly each year, that could be done with technologies, could be saved with technologies that completely exist, that when we think about the moral part, there needs to be as much or more emphasis on the word development as there is on the set of associations that come with the word sustainable. But they don't need to fight with each other.
trying to behave, but...
why don't you do a couple more brief comments here to the extent we have, and then open it up. I know other people want to hear the conversation. Please.
I don't know where to start.
I think the other problem we're having with issues like what is sustainable development, what is social entrepreneurship, all these buzzwords that come up, is we seem to think that it's a singular issue dealing with a singular problem. The issue is there's a level of complexity that we don't understand. I was just talking with a number of people that are in the terrorism panel, and we jokingly said we should be in each other's panels, because when I spoke to my students, we were doing work in Kashmir, and I spent a lot of time with USAID officials on the ground, and, you know, they despairingly and jokingly said, you know, with the lack of support that's actually being done and the local innovation for rebuilding up the Kashmir, who do you think is propping up the shortfall? And I said, NGOs. And they said, no, none of them showed up. Who do you think is funding it? Al-Qaeda, right? There's an analogy in issues that are happening very soon, very quickly, in mass urbanization, within and post-disaster situations, where things like terrorism, people don't become terrorists because they just want to kill people for the fun of it. They become terrorists because they have nothing to live for and everything to die for. And in a lot of these issues, and you can even talk about girls' education, you know, when a group says, look, give up one of your children and we will build you a school, a hospital, and we will help support, then that's how it's done. I mean, you know, everybody, and the other thing is about localization. For the cost of one U.S. consultant in Afghanistan, you can solar electrify a village, you can have a community that's trained with the skills to implement those and to keep those solar panels running. It's been done over and over again. Over 300 villages in India were solar electrified by the Barefoot College. There are no, and this is an Indian organization that was born out of a very rural area of Rajasthan by Bunker Roy, and he is a social entrepreneur that's been doing this for years. And there's many, many people out there, but we seem to think that technology is going to solve the answer to sustainable development as a top-down approach. We are not giving the tools to the right people. The people that need to have the access to share ideas, to share best practices, to be able to incorporate new technologies. For instance, when I talk about girls' education, you know what I want? I want toilets in schools, not more classrooms. The reason being is if you can collect all the rainwater in schools, which we do, you can utilize that for clean water so girls and boys will show up at school. You need a bathroom because when girls get to the age where, you know, they go through their puberty, they don't want to share a bathroom with a boy, or there is no bathroom. So there's simple, basic human things that we need to do. And I think we tend to spend our time on a meta level and not supporting people on a micro level. I mean, if we can do micro financing, why can't we do micro innovation? So.
Nancy, and then last comment, then we'll open it.
I wanted to, I'm going to avoid disagreeing with Larry because it is intimidating. And I actually agree with much of what he said. But I'd like to clarify one point in the interest of greater understanding in this group. And that is on the global climate change issue, there is not necessarily an investment that is needed, which we need to trade off against saving lives, educating girls. That's the problem in terms of climate change, is that it's not only free, it's politically costly, but in economic terms, we don't really face high costs of dealing with climate change. We could have a policy such as a carbon tax, which is what economists tend to like, which would help us as individuals internalize the costs of our emission of greenhouse gases. That carbon tax would actually be reducing overall costs in our society, indeed in the US and at the global level. it would be increasing our benefits to the extent that it would have this benefit of reducing even now pollution. What's interesting, local pollution, what's interesting is that in China, with income growth, the Chinese are starting to care about the pollution in their cities. And indeed, they're starting to even care about fossil fuel emissions because of the link to climate change. That's a product of, to some extent, the growth of a middle class in Shanghai, in Beijing. I'm not sure that I'm being very clear because I see a lot of puzzled looks, but it's interesting this Copenhagen consensus process occurred recently. Where there was a ranking of what should be done next and where would be the highest return. And I actually don't agree with the conclusion, because that on climate change, where they concluded that climate change was at the bottom of a list of 10 possible investments. But I disagree, because it's not clear at all that it's costly to us to take political steps that would lead to lower emissions. Let me just say about what Cameron said, as a development economist, absolutely right. We cannot do development from outside, top down. Development is really has to come from the ground up. And this is a real issue in the area of aid. How do we help with foreign aid without undermining the process of creative innovation at the ground level? And I think Cameron has one answer, which is get down there on the ground, and people like Jacqueline with Acumen have another answer. And that search for creative new approaches to achieving sustainable development through growth that is sustained in the developing world, through private sector-led growth, that's, I think, a big challenge for the 21st century. And it's not just, to go back to Larry's comments, a simple issue of, you know, comparing costs and benefits, unfortunately, of a set of options, because that set of options that we're looking at may not be complete. It doesn't take into account the creative solutions that people will find themselves given something, given the resources, given the incentives, given the social environment in which they live.
Okay. Very short, and then we have a queue started. You'll be first, and then second question was over here and third to you. Go ahead, Larry.
I'm with you much of the way, Nancy. I'm certainly with you, Cameron, on this all needs to be decentralized. A lot of individuals need to have separate incentives. There needs to be no top-down plan. I'm certainly with you that there's a lot that can be done that will reduce energy use and contribute to global warming that would be a good idea to do, even if there wasn't a global warming problem. And we should work on that. We should work on corruption in mining. We should work on subsidized energy prices. We should work on raising the price in prudent ways. It's all the right thing to do. What is not established, to put it mildly, is that by setting an overall top-down quota on how much can be emitted from the United States or from other countries, and simply insisting that governments engage in a set of regulation that meets the quota that the United States will put out 7% less gases in 2010 than it did in 1990 when it has an economy a third larger, to assert that that can be done costlessly is to go way beyond where contemporary economic analysis would suggest we are. And so to suggest that we can achieve all the things and there are no costs except for these political people who are getting in the way, I think is to go rather beyond what is currently supported. So yes, let's do all the win-win things. Let's purchase the insurance policy. But I guess I would insist that there does need to be careful analysis of what the consequences of the policies are in terms of our capacity as an economy to do to do other things.
Okay. We have about half an hour, so hopefully a good time for a lot of questions. We'll start back there, please.
Adam Tambara, opposition politician from Zimbabwe. I want to say that the problem is that we are trying to delink global challenges. You can't delink global challenges. I'll give you four global challenges. The global warming issue, extreme poverty, human rights, and terrorism. It doesn't matter which one you want to tackle. They're interconnected. You can't address global warming without talking about fighting for basic human rights. You can't address global warming without addressing the issue of extreme poverty. How can a starving peasant think about the green agenda? But they must. If they do not resolve their starvation and also think about global warming, they will not be able to do it in a sustainable way. So I think the problem that we're facing is we're addressing very important problems, but we're trying to delink them and put them in a hierarchical order. You cannot do that. Global terrorism, extreme poverty, human rights, and global warming are interconnected, and you must address them at every forum. We need a unified theory of everything.
Do we? Yeah. Should I repeat the comment back that we cannot de-link all of the issues that are tied together here? When we're talking about global warming, we need to address also basic human rights. And Cameron, do you want to comment on that?
The way you do that is that every human being is selfish. And that when you're working with the communities, when I'm working in southern India, they don't want to know, they're not going to watch Al Gore's movie. And they're certainly, because there's no cinema, but they're also, you know, they don't care about the amount of gases being emitted by the United States because they don't know, because it's all contextual. But they do care about the fact that it's so expensive to bring in an infrastructure that they want to be off the grid. So they're more sustainable than anyone in the room right now. They're using solar technology, they're using rainwater collection, and so it's, what you need is you need to have, we need to be less like oil tankers in the development world and more like the tugboat. You know, we need to be able to zip and move and be able to explain to very many different people a kind of same kind of vision, but through different eyes. So I think it's a translation issue, not just in languages, but also in mindset.
Hattie, did you? No. Okay. Second question over here, please.
Yes, thank you. My name is Antonio Rivas. I'm the manager of Sustainable Development Department at the Inter-American Development Bank. I wanted to play on the issue of the discussion has already raised, which is the Copenhagen consensus that purports to value the future benefits to be achieved. And Mr. Summers very quickly or correctly pointed out the power of compounding. Unfortunately, in the Copenhagen consensus, they use the power of discounting. In other words, they say that whatever benefits we're going to get out of climate change are so far removed in the future that if we apply any discount rate of 5, 6, 7%, they're simply zero, virtually zero. And of course, then we shouldn't be worried about the climate change issue. Mr. Summer, you very correctly pointed out that the values that the people had in 1997 are not the same as the values that we have in 2006, and are not the same that our population is going to have. Hence, who are we now to value? Because as you very well also said, your children are extremely concerned about the rising sea levels in the islands and in Florida. But we are, unfortunately, completely improperly valuing those economic, if you will, the economic value of the pricing of the environmental goods. So I think we don't have a conclusion, obviously, on this because it's an extremely complex issue. But I think that we have to take into account that many of these things are going to be valued completely different in the future than they are valued today. And we are making our decision based on what we value today, which may be a very nice air condition, we value very highly. Maybe your children will not value that very highly.
And I'll turn to Hattie, but the comment here was just the out of the Copenhagen consensus, the valuation of future changes to the environment. And Hattie, will you comment on that?
I have what may sound like an unrelated comment, but in terms of what's doable and what value do you replace on it from an economic standpoint, I remember when I first started hearing about debt relief for very poor countries, and it was a fringe idea. It was a sort of nutty, marginal idea that we can't do that. They've committed to these amounts. It's a fringe idea. That well-known economist Bono said, "Oh, but it must be done." And you know, there was a discussion among those who, among donor countries and recipient countries, and lo and behold, it was done. I only bring this up to say that what we're doing in this room is the right thing to be doing, which is continually questioning the conventional wisdom about what is doable.
It's right to debate all the aspects of it.
Let me say two things if I could. On debt relief, I agree with you. I was the one who led the U.S. effort to sell some of the IMF gold to support that debt relief effort. Look, just so everybody's clear on what the concepts are here, the Copenhagen Consensus was a group of really quite distinguished people who came together and sought to answer the question, if we had $50 billion to spend, what would do the most good for humanity? They came to the conclusion that global warming was at the bottom of that list relative to clean water and disease and a variety of other things. I'm not sure they got it right in terms of doing the analysis. I think they didn't take full account of some of the benefits of the policies that would reduce global warming. I think there are a variety of methodological questions, and so I'm not here to endorse that conclusion. Where I do think we do go badly wrong is when we declare that discounting with respect to the future isn't the right way to think about these things. If I can put aside $1 today and turn it into $50 at some point in the future, then that's got to be thought of as one of the options. And so, yes, let me be absolutely clear. Let me take a poll. Suppose I offered you two policies. The first policy, you would spend $1 today, and you would save two lives in 2030. The second policy, you would spend $1 today, and you would save one life today. Is there anyone in the, I would argue that anyone in the room who thinks that we're not better off spending the dollar today to save one life today is not thinking about the problem in a clear way. And that's because there's yet a better alternative. If you think that you'd like to do it in 2030, I'll give you an even better policy. Take the dollar today, let it accumulate till 2030, and then you'll be able to, and then it'll be $4, and you'll be able to save four lives in 2030.
The first person's going to be dead. I mean, that's the point.
I'm the one who's saving people today. I'm the one who's for right. The people who are on the brink of death today.
But you're
the one who's talking about the potential benefit 50 years from now of people we don't know yet. I mean, what I'm baffled by is the lack of moral force that is behind the people Sandy Thurman, who's sitting behind us, is working for, who have AIDS in Africa, the children who are being sold into prostitution today. What I can't understand is why there isn't more moral force around them relative to the amount of moral force that is around these more diffuse benefits that will come in the very long run. And so, yes, I do think it's right to think differently about benefits 50 years hence than to think about benefits today, both because of the immediacy, because of the opportunity to accumulate and do very large things for 2050. I think that is the right moral way to think. It's not an economic question. It's a moral question about which needs are most pressing.
If that's the way people have heard this cast, then they've certainly heard something different than I intended to cast it. I just spent the last 4 years of my life trying to work to make women agents of change in conflict situations, including all of the stakeholders in the management of IDP camps and the management of refugee camps. And in the last Aspen thing I co-hosted was on bringing potable water and basic sanitation to the poorest of the poor people in the world. That's what I do with my life. My point is was a different one, which is that because we now have because we have these three large countries with these giant populations, which now have the capacity to produce the quantity of CO2 that they're producing. And we're now in a different place with respect to climate change. It doesn't have anything to do with my lack of commitment to the immediate changes. And one of the things that pleases me the most about this discussion, the sustainable development discussion, is that there's now real traction for it. We in Washington, and all of us, at least the three of us, spend a lot of time in Washington. Every little bit, there's a task force that talks about the foreign assistance program in the United States and what we're going to do, and presents a position paper on what the next administration ought to do and how the budget ought to be done. Normally, they're attended by many fewer people in this room than are in this room, and normally it's, you know, another piece of paper, again, ignored by the Hill and by the next administration. I just went to one at CSIS in Brookings, two very good Washington institutions, put together a study of the foreign assistance program in the United States. The Bush administration, not my administration, I'm eager to say, but in this point, they have really put a bunch of money behind foreign assistance. It's foreign assistance. It is in 50 different implementers. It's a broken system. And this report from CSIS and Brookings was focused on how do we fix the U.S. foreign assistance program. They sent out invitations expecting a modest response. There were 300 people who responded. They had to cut off the acceptances, and people had to watch from auxiliary rooms instead of, and these were people who were gathered in little rooms watching a television program about foreign assistance instead of the World Cup. I mean, this is stunning, the amount of interest finally in this issue. That makes me very happy. The fact that the two richest guys in the world, not people who bet their money on lost causes, have now just committed these vast amounts of money to the issue we're discussing is a real cause for celebration. So I am enormously excited about all of that and celebrate.
Great. And Nancy had two sentences worth, and then we'll turn back to the audience.
I'll desist.
Okay.
You promise to give me the floor at some point.
Yes.
Later.
Raise your hand.
And
now, we had someone who was next in the queue, but are you on this same thread, or is there anyone? And okay, we've two here and then one over there. But to continue this thread, did you have an immediate quick comment on this? Or, sir, was yours on this thread?
Yeah, I have a short comment instead of a question.
Okay.
Well, a short comment is, I think Larry raises an interesting perspective that's a little bit different. I kind of wonder if you're a captain on a ship and you get two people in front of you and you can save them, or you can run back up to the bridge and try to save the whole ship, but three have 400 people on it. You know, what do you do in that moment? When you make an example where you say, well, I can save one child now, and in 2030 I can save two, that's not a hard question to answer. But I think it's an exaggeration of what might be going on. But it might be a much shorter time frame and a much larger number of people. I'm not sure those numbers are right. That's just a comment. I'd like to raise the issue of growth. And I have struggled for a long time just thinking about businesses, and in this case you're thinking about the whole world, but now, when you think about a company, it's funny how, like, I was thinking about once about Hewlett Packard, you know, why did they have to buy all these other companies? Why is it that a company can't get to a point where it says, okay, this is a good business, we're now doing a billion, that's how big we should be, we'll just be a billion-dollar company forever. But they don't. They either grow or they die. And it seems like economies are also, I never studied economics, it seems like economies are sort of based on the same notion, we either grow or we go down. We don't very often stop. So when you talk about sustainable development, you're also talking a lot about growth. If I go to a country where 30% of the kids are dying and I say, look, we're going to do a 2% a year improvement, well, you can probably sustain that, but it really leaves the whole problem still right in front of you. You haven't gotten very far. And I kind of wonder, you know, are there countries that have really address the issue of sustainable growth where they've gotten to a certain size and they're not just going crazy building bigger houses and buying more cars and going on and on and on and on, but they're just trying to say, enough is enough. When is enough enough? And what is the growth target for these countries? You've got a country that's, you know, people make $1,000 a year, we're trying to get to $1,010 a year, or to get them to $5,000 a year, can the whole world afford what level of growth? Is there a place where we come where we say, gee, now the whole system is sustainable because, you know, we're getting enough food, we have air we can breathe, we have enough energy to heat, cool, light, and so forth.
I'm going to take
take a suggestion Nancy made here and have a few people comment or ask questions and then turn back to the panel just so others can get in. And I know we have you in the queue. We had you next, I think. And then we had a question down here, and we'll get you all in. Let's work our way around the room here. Why don't you start, please, and try to keep them short and to the point if you could.
First of all, I think poverty itself is very destructive of the environment. We often neglect. Development is destructive, but I think poverty is even more destructive. Second one is Professor Summers' whole argument is based on the record of market mechanism and technological innovation in the past hundreds of years in raising the standard of living. And my question is, A, do you think that there's uncertainty in the next 100 years that will probably change how these two mechanisms perform because of the differences in the context, the challenges themselves? And I think Mrs. Babbitt raised the issue of just the game may be very different. So will the tricks we've used to use to deal with the challenge be still be useful? So this is the uncertainty issue.
Mechanisms?
No, market mechanism in
market and technology.
Allocating resources efficiently and also using science and technology to deal with these challenges.
I think you had a question, yes.
My question is, as you address these problems and you talk about theory, but isn't the reality that birth control is the bedrock of sustained development? My question is, if you have too many people trying to use limited resources, how can you have progress and how can you have sustained development with a pretty controlled population? And my example would be, look at the progress China made when she finally decided to control population.
Why don't we take your comment and then I'll come back to you.
Okay, thanks. Really, three points which, rather like Arthur, I see is very interlinked. The first is the nature of people, and that is, most people are experiential learners, and the experience of the community in this room doesn't relate to the developing world. And any of you, I mean, there are a few of us here who've lived in and worked in and exist in the developing world, and we have a different paradigm. And I constantly hear that paradigm disconnect. And it's a question of what are the facts rather than what is the perception, and how do we deal with that? How do we move that forward? The second is micro versus macro. It's got to be a micro solution. You can't do this on a macro basis. It's failed. Mm-hmm. And somebody said yesterday, $400 billion of aid to Africa in the last 40 years, what's it given us? Squat. By contrast, if you look at the businesses that have invested on a micro level and created sustainability, that's created an enormous amount of value. It's created jobs. It's created some level of economic activity which is sustainable, whether or not in the long term. You want me to accelerate or speak up? Okay. And then the final point is really what is at the core of making this all possible. And again, that plays back to the issue of perception. And I would argue that the perception in the developed world is that there are certain things that are taken for granted which simply cannot be taken for granted in the developing world. And one of the key aspects of that is the right to a right, and how that is enforced. If you have no property rights, even though you have a piece of paper that's effectively a so-called rule of law, how can you invest? If you aren't able to protect your own human rights, how can you invest? And I bet every single person in the room will pay lip service to that, but won't think about it. Mm-hmm. And without that, the developing world is going to really, really struggle to get onto the ladder. Now, in terms of what I've heard, there have been some really, really interesting and important points in the room. I think it's great. But I think we actually have to broaden the debate and make it more engaged and more holistic.
Thank you. Please.
Larry, what is the foundation's amount of money that the Harvard Foundation has at this point?
What?
The Harvard Foundation.
Harvard Endowment has $28 billion.
Okay. And Harvard's endowment of $28 billion. And Buffett and Gates Foundation have together now $100 billion. No, 60 plus Harvard. I'm Andy Harvard.
Buffett Gates, I don't know why I combined them, but Buffett
plus Gates plus Harvard is 90 is his point.
Okay, 90. Okay, if you spend 5%, 10%, and the most of the foundations spend about 5% a year, you would, as I calculate, in 50 years have something in the area of $10,000 billion. $10,000 billion. Now, that takes into the event of spending the money now and having the money in the future and having the money for ultimate serious world consequence problems. And I would hope that among the foundations, Larry doesn't control the Harvard Foundation anymore or the Harvard Endowment, but there are other endowments in this world that will grow in that fashion. And those have enormous power to deal with the problems of the world. And I think some of them, and most of them, are focusing on those problems of the world.
Great. Why don't we take just one or two more comments, and then we'll give these folks a chance to answer. I think you had your hand up.
I have two questions. One of them is for Cameron. And I was referring to what Arthur was saying about the global, the human rights and the terrorism, and how in these grassroots projects and the microcosmic infrastructures that are being built, how do you guard, what do you do with security, how do you make them secure? I understand how you make them environmental, but how do you secure these, because distribution and all of that is always such a big issue when you are trying to do anything in any of these countries, from local despots or terrorists. And my other question was for Nancy, and it was referring to one of her proposals. How can we, the United States, be a role model for any other country, whether it's on a microcosmic or macrocosmic level?
And statistics shows, you know, last 50 years, with this, despite the material world, you know, people are not happy. And, you know, the happiness level is basically the level of, I mean, it's the same in the last 50 years. So if you don't, you know, if people do not look internally for that, you know, I cannot see the world can sustain itself. I mean, you know, China is now growing at, well, basically 9% for the last 30 years. India is now coming up with, what, 6-7% in the last 5 years. It's 2.5 billion people. 2.5 billion people, everybody basically shooting for, you know, the living standard. You know, we all look at, you know, the propaganda, the media all say, well, the living standard, the U.S. middle class living standard, that's what everybody should aspire to. I mean, 2.5 billion people, if everybody wants that kind of standard, you're never going to get there with the world's resources. And what you have, if you don't, you cannot get people to look internally for happiness, what you're going to have, you know, you got people say, we have the right to achieve that. Now we are deprived of that right. That what you have. You have a revolution.
We can probably run about another 10 minutes total, so it'll be a challenge, but why don't we get comments back from each of you. Do you want to start, Cameron? Yeah.
First,
Thank you.
I'm going to try and sum up three different comments. One, the waste in Africa, and the comment you made about communities and security, but also the $1 statement. The reason I jumped in was because what we're looking at a global level, we look at, you know, 5 billion people living in poverty, but that's how we look at it. We don't look at the idea of different layers within that. So within that, there's 1.5 billion people, which we're calling the global middle class. They're in a standard of living where they're willing to invest in their own future because they have a small amount of capital. We see it as minimal, but they see it as small. And so, you know, they're willing to invest $25 a day. They may only be getting $5 or $6 a day, but they'll invest that in improving the living standards of their own life. So sustainable development, we found, and this is just a model, because when we talk about corruption, people think it happens within the country that you're doing the development. But in countries in Africa we're working with, they say much of the corruption happens before it arrives. We just call them consultants. Now, what's happening in Sri Lanka is we're working with UN Habitat, and I'm sure they're not going to like me telling you this, but they've run out of money, and we're actually bailing them out of doing some community-based school and some school building. And the community itself is about 1,000 families, and they're each investing financially a very small amount, but they're stakeholders in the rebuilding of their own community. So they are very, very active in the way they want their community built. They're also very, very active in job creation and the idea that it's not just about doing singular buildings, but the whole a holistic approach to rebuilding. So what I see in the future is not the let's us all save a dollar. It's how do we enable and engage the global community to be active participants both financially and as a vocal point in their own future rather than dictating it. So,
anyway. Maybe what I'll do is pick off a couple of questions and address the issue about population and the issue with from the man in the, over in this corner who talked about this being a discussion among folks from the developed country, not in the language or with from the background of the developing country. One of the great challenges, of course, are all these cultural and societal elements that we bring to the table and that people in developing countries bring to the table. It's the political will that must be managed on both sides to make the changes that allow these developments to happen. On the population front, the least likely place that I can imagine for there to be a successful population program would be Iran. After the fall of the Shah and the Islamic Revolution, the leaders came in and said, all this population stuff that the Shah has been doing, those are all Western values. We reject it. We are going to implement policies with respect to women that mean that women have their identity solely through males, that they must dress in very conservative ways and be covered. We will lower the age of marriage to 9, and we will eliminate all that birth control stuff. The population of Iran grew to, and by the early 90s, 7 births per woman. That's a lot. After the Iran-Iraq War, those same religious leaders looked at life and said, we can't possibly sustain economic growth at 7 births per woman. And they issued fatwas. Those fatwas said, all right, we're going to okay, it's going to be okay to use contraception, including all versions of contraception. And the birth rate in Iran plummeted. It is now 1.8 births per woman. This happened in the period between 1999, the year after the Iran-Iraq War ended, and 2005. Those are stunning reversals in a society where you would not imagine that that kind of thing can happen. So I use this example to say, let's never get into the idea that change can't happen on our side or on the other side, that you've always got to be looking for the right kind of political leadership. I would venture to say that the leaders in the Islamic Republic have had the wrong kind of leadership with respect to virtually every other issue. But here they've really recognized an issue and solved it. In terms of the how it is that we have a common language, that we figure out how to work in various parts of the developing world, that's the hardest possible issue. It is absolutely the hardest. We can argue economic theory and argue global climate change and argue the rest of it, the hardest part. I think we overcome it in the United States to the extent we can by figuring out how it is that we regain our moral authority. We have lost our moral authority in the world. It was our ace. We were seen as beacons of freedom. We were seen as beacons of hope. You can't bring hope through shock and awe. You can't bring hope unilaterally. You have to listen. You have to have a process by which you are communicating the right set of values. The reason I was so eager to be part of the Aspen Institute issue with respect to potable water and basic sanitation for the developing world was I thought this is a concrete, identifiable, doable something which the United States can, where the United States can be a leader and where it is easy to understand on all sides that it is a good. It's not complicated with politics. It's not complicated with the rest of it. It's not as complicated. So I think the point, and this is a little bit to the woman in this direction, I think the main missing ingredient in the discussion with respect to the United States is the regaining of the moral authority that we must have in order to be effective at doing what everybody in the room wants to do.
Quick sprint. Nancy?
Well, I'll just say five things randomly, almost, trying to respond to comments. I loved the question, when is enough enough? I think the answer is basically that tastes, values, preferences do shift with income growth, and we're already seeing some of that in our own society. In the U.S., our air is cleaner. Our rivers are cleaner. We spend more on health care, which is fundamentally not throughput in the material sense of creating problems. We spend more on tourism. We spend more on eating out. We are shifting more and more to a service and information economy, which you could think of as being more sustainable insofar as we use fewer material resources. Can we be a role model? I think it's a great question. I think we are and can be a role model on the reality of democratic discourse here, the strength of civil society, exactly what's happening in this conversation in this room. At the same time, I think at the moment we have lost our moral authority. We have lost our way. And it's not because of difficult trade-offs on the cost of investing in this or the cost of investing in that. It's because our politics has been increasingly difficult, and we are not, through our democratic system, really addressing common needs in an effective way, either for us or for the world. About population, we know that people will only have fewer children when infant mortality has fallen, which in the short run would seem to increase the number of people, when they have security and stability, when they can be comfortable about in old age, they will be safe, when as women they're sure that they don't need to have a son to physically protect their property as an adult from being pillaged, being stolen. If they are widows, when they are empowered and have dignity. In that sense, you know, reducing population numbers turns out to be very much about producing development. It is also true that part of human rights and development is having access and information about family planning. It's not a substitute, but it can be. We know it accelerates the rate at which people are empowered, women are empowered, to have the number of children they want. The best investment in sustainable development in places like Africa is for sure girls' education and access to family planning. There is analysis that suggests that will reduce use of forests, a sink for carbon emissions, more quickly than a direct attack on restricting or somehow impeding people from using the forest. That's an example, I think, of what Larry has been trying to say, but it also is an example of what Arthur's saying, that all of these things, they feed on and reinforce each other in a positive way. If we can, you know, help people find their own creative solutions. I think Minchin asked a fascinating question. Will the game be different in the future? Will we have the same ability to tap technological innovation and to use market mechanisms? And I don't think it will change at the country level, but I think we've got to worry about how to make it work at the global level, where we don't have a mechanism for societies, for nation states to cooperate effectively among themselves. And that's why climate change is so challenging as a problem.
Thank you. Last word to you, Larry. Last words, I guess.
Say just a few things. First, I'd refer anybody to Ben Friedman, who's here this week's book on the subject of economic growth, which I think makes a compelling case that it's what people want and it's what people should want. If you ask the American people as a group today, not the people who come to Aspen, but the American people as a cross-section, the leading problem the American people see is that the middle class can't keep up with all the things they need and needs to have more prosperity. And any public policy approach that pretends that that's not so is not going to be politically supported and is not going to succeed. And standards of living in the United States are 10 times standards of living in India and China. So any idea that's around stopping growth because we already have enough as the secure to any ill will be, and I would argue should be, a political non-starter with the world's populations.
We shouldn't worry that more growth will generate more bads.
Properly managed, more growth will prove to be sustainable. There has been, I can go back and I can cite you the report from every 25 years for the last 150 about how we're going to bring the planet to an end with an accumulation of growth. It was written absolutely compellingly in the 1970s, and it was absolutely certain that there was going to be famine in India and China. It's what I was taught when I was an undergraduate in college, and it didn't happen because of technology. So, yes, we can't be certain what's going to happen with respect to technology, but there are half a dozen more reasons to think that progress is going to be greater over the next century than there are to think that progress is going to be less over the next century, most of which come from the fact that we don't need fundamental new ideas. We need the better dissemination of the ideas we already have to India and China to make a great difference. There's an enormous amount that we all agree on: potable water, empowerment of education of women, more support for NGOs who are doing things on the ground, drawing the energies from indigenous people, beginning to think about taking the right global insurance policies with respect to climate change. So the fact that we have some differences of opinion shouldn't blind us to what we agree on. But there is one tension that I think that I hadn't really thought about before, that I think the policy community needs to be aware of, which is that most people in this room have two convictions that I think they probably hold. One is, whenever anybody says we should take a micro approach, not a macro approach, they find that intuitive and natural and something that feels right to them. The other is that they want a big climate change plan like Kyoto. Whatever else it was, Kyoto was a 100% top-down macro approach. And so there is some tension between the deep conviction that we need an immediate comprehensive global climate plan and this commitment to taking more micro approaches. And my own view is that the Bush administration has given good sense and voluntarism a bad name by using it as an excuse for negative do-nothingism. But that if we're going to make real progress, and 20 years from now somebody's going to look back and say that in this quarter century a real start was made with respect to global climate change, I think we're going to need to find more decentralized, more voluntaristic, less coercive top-down approaches to climate change than the kind of schemes that are talked about. Because I don't think we actually want a world where governments are charged with mandating within their economies the precise amount of energy that can be used, and where they're paying tens of billions of dollars across international borders to each other on the strength of how that plays out. And so the big challenge I would leave people with is, how do we approach climate change but do so in a way that's faithful to the commitment to decentralized micro that we tend to think is the most effective way of doing things in the global arena?
Thanks, all of our panelists. Thanks to you all.
Thank you. Thank you.